Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 70 articles on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two young children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back.
Hey, I'm here, ready to go. Thanks, Bill.
There we go. It might help if you're on the air. There you go. And so at the beginning of every show, we always go back and revisit the last month's conservation tip. And last month, what did you have for us?
We talked about bird watching with a purpose. We introduced some listeners, possibly introduced them to something called being a citizen scientist. And that's where you can bird with a purpose by submitting to national databases like eBird or iNaturalist. And actually, eBird is global. You can go anywhere on the planet and they want to know what you saw. And when thousands and tens of thousands of observers are doing this, there's some meaningful good stuff in there. So we also brought up that because this is we're approaching the Christmas bird count season, and that's the oldest way that bird watchers have contributed to science, and it's been going on since 1900. And we can look at a lot of trends with Christmas bird count data. We can see that there are some species that are what we call eruptive, that show up some years and maybe don't show up for 3 or 4 years, and here they come again. Things like red-breasted nuthatch is a really good example. Purple finch is another, depending on where you are in the country. But for this listening area, those are two really good ones. And we can see waterfowl numbers, for example, go up and down. It might be depending on climate. If it's too warm, why come to the south if you don't have to? Or if it's too dry, there's maybe no place to park. So they keep going. So become a citizen scientist, consider birding with a purpose, and investigate things like eBird and iNaturalist. You can even do those with apps on your smartphone. So while you're in the field, you can turn in your birds while you see them, and it's meaningful. So consider becoming a citizen scientist.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We'd love to have your questions and calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything having to do with birds in our avian world is fair game for tonight's program. And last month, we had a spotlight bird, and this month, we're going to have another one. What do you have for us this month?
Yeah, we're going to talk about the belted kingfisher this month. They're quite vocal, but not at all musical, as we'll hear now.
Sounds like clacking.
Yeah, it's very vocal, like I said, not very musical. You can hear that out on waterways in the listening area. Actually, just about anywhere in the U.S. you can hear that if there's water around. We have a photo of a kingfisher, a belted kingfisher, in a very interesting pose snapped by James Childress of Lufkin. It's on the Bird Calls webpage at redriverradio.org. You'll notice in that photo that it's a female because of the cinnamon-colored band across the belly and along the flanks. Males don't have that cinnamon color, so those areas instead are white. This means that the female is more colorful than the male in the belted kingfisher, which is very unusual in the bird world. It's typically the opposite. It's mostly a blue-gray and white bird. The name belted refers to the bluish band across the breast of both males and females. Of the roughly 90 species of kingfishers on the planet, 3 of them occur in the U.S., with the belted being the most common and the most widespread. This species is smaller than a crow. It has a stout, long bill and a shaggy crest. They're found year-round throughout the Red River Radio listening area, but they're easier to find during the colder months as more northerly breeding kingfishers overwinter here due to our mild conditions and open water that never freezes over. As implied with the name kingfisher, these birds are masters at catching small fish and other large critters, lots of aquatic invertebrates. They either lunge from a perch overhanging water, or they'll hover about 15, 20 feet directly over the water before quickly diving and grabbing a tasty fish within about 2.5 inches of the water surface. So people that are out on boats often have the best experience watching a kingfisher hover and catch a fish. Kingfishers nest in burrows that they dig horizontally through the side of an earthen bank, and it may tunnel back 3 to 6 feet, and that's where they lay on average 4 snow white eggs per clutch. And so the kingfisher is I just love that bird. I think it's such a neat bird. And even though it's not very musical, but it is vocal, it sure grabs your attention when you hear that call that we played. There's nothing else like it in the area. So
it adds an interesting chatter to the forest soundscape.
Yeah, yeah. And you might hear that in the forest if you're near a river or a creek or between waterways. They have to fly over forest sometimes to get from creek to creek, and so you'll hear that a lot. So when you have your ears open, listen for that and know that that's the belted kingfisher.
And I believe that's the one that I have heard out at Lake Bistineau.
Okay.
When I go out there, which is a beautiful place to yeah. go and both go birding and just, for naturalist fun. So,
right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we'd like to have your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding the avian world and birds is welcome tonight, as Cliff is our resident ornithologist. And Cliff, we're coming up on the Christmas bird count season, and you have a list of the various bird counts that are taking place throughout our area for those birders who would like to participate. Why don't we go through that?
Yeah, we've put up almost a dozen different counts in the listening area. And those are, by the way, on the Red River Radio website, on the Bird Calls webpage. We list different dates and the count name. And also the most important part is the compiler and that person's email address, because those people are integral in this. They are assembling teams, dispatching birders to certain areas, and ensuring that areas aren't covered by two different groups to avoid double counting. So you want to make sure you contact the compiler. There, if you don't want to go afield, you can also, if you live inside the count circle, like some communities, you might be able to submit your feeder count. In other words, birds that are coming to your feeder or feeders. And one of the groups of birds we really are interested in, if you're maintaining a hummingbird feeder and you have an overwintering hummingbird, and I personally, my wife and I, we had a Rufus hummingbird that showed up on of all days, Halloween, that's easy to remember, October 31st, and it stayed with us for a month, and we haven't seen it in the last week now. It's gotten frigidly cold. That cold has really zapped our Turk's cap and anything else that was still flowering, but that doesn't mean that we haven't stopped putting our feeder out. And it's an old wives' tale to take your feeder down. Birds are hardwired to migrate, so just because you keep your feeder up doesn't mean you're going to keep that hummingbird from migrating. Instead, you might be hosting a wintering hummingbird like we have been for the last 4 of the last 5 weeks, roughly. So hopefully our Rufus will come back, because my yard is just inside the circle for the Nacogdoches count, and I work with the count compilers there, David and Mimi Wolf, and our fingers are crossed that our Rufus hummingbird will come back, because that's such a hard bird to get on a Christmas count. But again, they still would want, if you're a feeder watcher, they still want to know how many chickadees and how many cardinals and juncos and so forth. You want to be very conservative, so most backyards are only going to have one pair of chickadees and maybe one pair of titmice, so they'll come back, you know, maybe 15, 20 times during the day. So don't turn in 15 chickadees. Try to be conservative and realize you've just got that one pair in your area. But all of a sudden, you'll have maybe 15 American goldfinches or 20 chipping sparrows descend on your feeder, and clearly those are each individual bird. So, but I encourage people to go to our website on our page there and see if they're in the count circle and if the date works with them, and more importantly, work with the compiler and get hooked up with a Christmas count, and then you can become a citizen scientist that we talked about a few minutes ago.
All right. And you can take your kids out and have them enjoy this as well.
That's right.
There's nothing like little scientists. They are wide-eyed and wonderful, and they go out and they see everything. They want to know everything.
Yeah, and we've taken our kids out. You know, we have middle school-age kids that we take out in the field. We don't try to cram birding down their throats, but we do encourage them to go out with us. And if they want to throw rocks or look at frogs or pick up turtles or have a stick and, you know, whack it at a rock or something like that, as long as they're outside, they're absorbing stuff. And I think that's really critical in today's age, is to get those young people out. And also, I should mention in our intro where we say Cliff and Julie live in East Texas and have two young kids, my wife and kids have complained that we got to update that. Yeah, they're not young anymore in their own eyes. They're age 11 and 13. I think that's young, but they're not, you know, diaper kids anymore, of course.
Well, I'm 55 and I try to be young, so.
So.
Right, we'll get that updated just so that they know, Julie.
Yeah.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birding and birds is welcome tonight. And we did have a submission online from listener Sarah Fuller. She recorded this down in a mixed pinewood hardwood lot in Nacogdoches this summer, and she wanted to know if this was a dove species.
Okay, let's listen.
As you can tell, there's a lot of noise in the background, but you could definitely hear that kind of a squawking, almost hooing, you know, like
right.
A difference between the two.
And I read what she said is that it was in the summertime, and that's really critical, is to, if you do make a sound recording, even with your cell phone, and submit it, which we love, is tell us when you did it. Maybe not the exact date, but the month, because this is a bird that is not going to be here this time of the year, or at least shouldn't be. But the bird that is going goo, 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 goo is what locals call a rain crow. But if you look through your bird book, you're not going to find rain crow. You're going to find him named as the yellow-billed cuckoo. And funny name, and yes, we do have cuckoos in the listening area. This bird occurs throughout the U.S., and it's a common call that you'll hear. That's one of several calls. That's the monotonous coo call, but they also make different types of calls that old timers and farmers are familiar with, and they call it rain crow. You know, it kind of got mixed up, I think, that's, you know, someone said, well, they call to predict the rain, and if you hear the call of a rain crow, it's going to rain. That's not correct. What instead, it's one of the few birds you'll hear calling during a light rainstorm, and so I think that's really where the name came from. But these birds are not predicting rainfall. But that's the yellow-billed cuckoo, and Sarah did a really good job recording it. It's a simple call, or she probably had a simple recording device, a cell phone set on video, where you don't worry about what it's shooting visually, but you're capturing the sound with the microphone, and she sent that to us. And Bill, you probably cleaned it up a little bit to get some of the noise out, but it's a decent recording of the yellow-billed cuckoo. Do we want to hear it maybe one more time?
Yes, let's go ahead and give that. She actually sent in two, and I'm going to play them both back to back. Can hear a lot of other birds in that one. What were the other birds?
Yeah, I think you fuzzed them out such that I can't really tell. Okay. There's two or three species singing on top of each other, and it makes it a little difficult. But the cuckoo does really stick out in those, and I'm glad. So Sarah, your bird is a yellow-billed cuckoo, and I think a lot of people that have had their ears open and in the woods in the summertime will recognize that call of the yellow-billed cuckoo, also known as the rain crow.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birding and the avian world is welcome. And we're going to go to our first call tonight, Thomas from Hallsville, Texas. Thomas, what's your question tonight?
Oh, hi. Yeah, it's not really a question. It's more of a comment. And that was, you guys were talking about the kingfisher.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I'm calling from Longview, but oh, okay. I had lived on the river, the Sabine River around here. And, I mean, right on the river. And for about 15 years. And the... It is surrounded by woods and hundreds of acres of woods. I was, you know, anyway, in a very secluded area. And but I used to go down to the riverbank, I mean, often in those 15 years. And, of course, it's all wooded, rather thick woods. But anyway, and just sit quiet. And you would, oh, God, you know, if people would just do that, go there and sit for 20 minutes, and you'll see something that you've never seen before,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And it may be a, you know, a fish or a bird or something. But anyway, I just see, you know, the kingfisher that was, you know, a bird. And I don't know if it's the same guy every time, but anyway, he was kind of busy around there, you know, perched up and somewhere, and you could hear his call, and then he'd, you know, fly in the middle of the river, you know, kind of scanning things, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one particular time, it was, you know, getting evening time, and I just happened to be wading in a shallow part of the river with a, you know, a rod and reel, and just a little bitty, you know, like a popper little thing, looking, you know, fishing for perch and kind of popping the water.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't know was there's a kingfish or a kingfisher up there, you know, kind of watching all this going on.
Oh.
And he dove down and tried to hit that. I'm so glad he didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. But, I mean, it was just amazing. You know?
Right.
But he just saw a little action going in the water, and, I mean, he made a dart for it. And but it was just really fun, you know, seeing, you know, the kingfisher fish.
That's neat. That's neat.
Yeah, yeah, it was really neat.
Yeah.
And another thing is that, I mean, we had feeders out, you know, for the first 5 or 6 years there and in our backyard, which, like I say, this is way out in the woods, and bird feeders and so forth. And in the wintertime was especially fun because you'd see birds you'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And me and my wife, we bought a book, you know, on birds, you know, that were, and I haven't been a bird watcher per se. I've always appreciated birds. But anyway, so we bought a book to identify birds.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't believe the birds that migrate through here.
Yep.
And that we could identify. And two in particular, and one would be the golden finch.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, those were just beautiful birds.
Mm-hmm.
And but they would come and, you know, feed at a feeder. And it wouldn't last too long, but, you know, they had several weeks, you know, they kind of passed through. And the other was, and I think it was the, they would be on the ground. They mm-hmm. wouldn't be at the feeder,
mm-hmm.
but they would be on the ground. And they looked like just big, fat woodpeckers.
Hmm.
But from the description, the best we could tell, those were yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Okay.
Does that sound like a yellow-bellied flicker?
No, they don't go on the ground very often, but the northern flicker does, and it used to be called yellow-shafted flicker, and they'll go on the ground and feed. Oh. So I would bet you had a flicker on the ground.
Oh, maybe so. Yep, yeah, yep. They're probably about the size of a dove.
Yeah, and a little plumper maybe, not as long a tail, but yep.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. And they flash a lot of yellow under the wings and tail, and then when they're going away from you, a big white rump patch.
That would be the guy.
Yep, that's him. That's the northern flicker. If you learned birds 40 years ago, you learned it as the yellow-shafted flicker.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or if you're looking at an old bird guide, bird book, mm-hmm. that it would call mm-hmm. it that. But mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. and so you bring up a good point about birds come into bait. You need to be careful of that. Coastal fishermen always have to watch out for, even when they're casting, they might actually, you know, hit a bird that's on the wing, maybe get the line tangled around it. Yeah, and fishing line is a death trap for a lot of critters. So,
I bet you, man. So, I would have broke my heart if he mm-hmm. you know, if he caught that little thing.
Right.
And because it was just small enough. I mean, I was fishing for a little perch, you know, a little, and I mean, he grabbed it, pulled it out of the water, but he didn't get it.
Yeah.
But that would have been terrible.
That's right. You know? So a shout out to anglers, you know, is to make sure when you cut your extra line because you got a knot. Mm-hmm. Or you got a problem, don't throw it on the ground. Make sure it gets into the garbage, because that wad of fishing line is going to get somebody in trouble, mm-hmm. some mammal, some bird. And especially on the coast, it's a big issue for a lot of our birds. Mm-hmm. So, but we appreciate your call, Thomas. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your show.
Okay.
I love it.
Okay. Oh, great. Thank you, sir.
Now, I was curious, the yellow finch, is that any relation to the house finch then?
It is not. It's distantly, of course. And that was the American goldfinch that he was talking right. about. And there are house finches. They're not very closely related, but they do both occur in this area in the winter. The house finch is year-round. The goldfinch is during the colder months. And they will occur side by side on your feeder. They really like black oil sunflower, and they really like thistle. Thistle's expensive. You kind of don't want to feed all the red-winged blackbirds and grackles, so a lot of people are really selective on thistles, and they get specific feeders that are fir thistle, and that you have to have a small bill to get it out. Hmm. But black oil sunflower is your best bet for all these birds, and you will, again, get house finch and American goldfinch sitting side by side on your feeder this time of the year.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we're ready to take your question tonight. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birding is welcome. And I did have one question about these kingfishers when they're hovering over the water. Now, I know when I go fishing, I cannot see through the surface glare on the water.
Yeah.
So how is it, what is it about the bird's eye, specifically the hunter birds that hunt for fish, that allows them to see through that glare and the distortion of the water and literally pinpoint piercing that
right.
fish like
well,
that?
Well, superior vision is definitely the key. And the reason they're hovering is they're judging, they're looking, they're recalculating, they're waiting for that moment that the fish isn't too deep and that it's, you know, the right size, that they can handle it. And the, just, I think, superior vision and just waiting for that right moment where the glare is just right. So it might be a glare at your angle, but, you know, that bird is definitely doing something right. Otherwise, they would starve to death, wouldn't they? So they're clearly doing something right. So maybe at that height, hovering at the right angle, they just have it a clear view.
Maybe some of our ophthalmologists out there can call in.
Because yeah.
I was wondering, you know, as a photographer, I use polarizing filters to kind of see through some of that glare. And I'm wondering whether their eyes are naturally equipped with some kind
yeah.
of polarizing thing on the lens that allows them to cut right through the glare and the surface water clutter and literally see into the water.
Yeah, and I'm no bird eye expert, so
all right, so
I don't
bird
know many
doctors,
yeah.
give us a call at 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we'll take your questions tonight at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And you have a meeting that you want to mention coming up. And then, Preston, you're on hold right now, and Pat from Lufkin, you as well. Please hang on the line.
Yeah, we're hosting in Nacogdoches in the Red River listening area. We're hosting the winter meeting of the Texas Ornithological Society, and I'm really excited about that. There's a bunch of people in my community that are are planning and getting everything together and hopefully going to have a slam dunk meeting. And the dates are January 11th through the 14th. Again, in Nacogdoches, go to texasbirds.org and look up the Texas Ornithological Society's winter meeting and hope to see you there. There are going to be some evening lectures, three evenings in a row, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. There's Saturday one is a banquet. There's field trips all day. Field trips every day that you can sign up for. Many of them are full, but there's still a lot of really cool field trips that have availability. So I'm going to be there. I'll be one of the field trip leaders. I'll be at the evening events, and I look forward to meeting listeners that want to come to our Texas Ornithological Society meeting.
And you just had a meeting up here in the Red River Radio
area,
right here in our studio.
Yes, we had a planning meeting. We had to meet with Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, and so Shreveport is kind of the center of this ecoregion that we're in, and so we were just, you know, struggling to think of a meeting place, and I thought of the studio here, and mm-hmm. you guys were so gracious to let us meet here, and those that couldn't make it, we called them on a conference call, and several of the states made it. We had a really cool meeting right here. I doubt in the studio you've ever had a bird meeting where normally there's music playing.
Well, we've had all kinds of things in that studio. That's our packing room and our meeting room. And we actually have our community advisory board meetings in there. So that's a regular thing. So, yeah, we use that all year long. That's what's nice about having that studio here. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have several calls online, but there is lines open. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Preston from Bossier City. Preston, what's on your mind tonight?
I was wondering, I've had some redneck hummingbirds in my backyard.
Ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Yes, sir.
Okay, good.
And I was wondering where they go to migrate for the winter.
Okay, that's a great question. So, yep, they show up in our listening area in the latter half of March, and they'll stay with us for, till about September, October, and then they leave us, and they go points farther south. Most of them are going to Mexico through Costa Rica. And in that part of Central America is where you can find wintering ruby-throated hummingbirds. There are a few records in Panama. I don't think there's maybe one record on the South American continent, probably zero. But that area, so again, from Mexico, say Central Mexico through Costa Rica is where our ruby throats winter. And guess what? In late March, they're going to come right back to your backyard in Bossier. So, Preston, what are you doing to encourage ruby throats in your backyard?
I just have three hummingbird feeders.
Okay, cool. And are you helping your folks clean them out every 3 or 4 days?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good, because that's what we want to do in the hot summer, that nectar that we brew up, it's 4 parts water, 1 part sugar. We want to replace that every 3 or 4 days, even if they didn't drink at all. And that way it stays fresh. Think about, you know, kind of like curdled milk in the fridge. You don't want to drink it when it's gotten old. And that sugar water can get old. So, good. And are you enjoying those hummingbirds?
Yes, sir.
Good. Well, keep your feeder out. In Bossier, it's mild enough that if you do have a wintering one, like I mentioned earlier, we had one in our backyard in Nacogdoches. You could get lucky if you've got your feeder up, and if there's a wintering hummingbird, and the number one wintering hummingbird is going to be Rufus hummingbird. We had a female, which isn't quite as colorful as a male, but if you can get a male Rufus, you're going to be hooked, Preston. It's a gorgeous bird.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I ask, Preston, how old are you?
I'm 11.
All right, cool.
Awesome. So you're 6th grade?
I'm 5th.
5th grade. Okay, good. Well, guess what? You'll be in 6th grade next year, right?
There you go.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, good. Well, you tell your science teacher you called and asked about birds, because I think you'll get a smiley face.
And you made your radio debut, so you can tell all your friends.
Yep, good job.
Thank Thank you.
All right, thank you,
You're
Preston.
You're welcome, Preston. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You could give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We go next to Pat from Lufkin. And Pierre and Diane, please hang on the line. We'll be with you in just a moment. Pat from Lufkin, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, what I was kind of noticing is that I live in Lufkin, but I quite often go out to Lake Sam Rayburn on the north end of the lake where the 103 bridge crosses over. And quite often I see there's a family of American bald eagles that live on the lake there. Mm-hmm. And their nest is like in the middle of the lake on some old, dead old trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes along with what y'all were talking about before about the how they catch fish. And I'm always amazed when I see them catching fish, zooming over the water, and then, their talons go down and they catch a fish. I've seen it a couple of times. It's
cool.
So, so cool to watch.
Yep.
But this was only in about 2 foot of water or so, and I saw American bald eagle catch a fish one day, and he caught it and flew away with it, I guess, back to the nest. You know, what I've always been told is that, there's a certain amount of limited food supply for birds like that, and so, like, each bird kind of has its own territory. And so is there enough lake and fish for them to keep expanding that family of American bald eagles? Are they going to have a branch out into another area to go fishing or catch rodents or whatever?
Well, certainly when those young of the year get big enough, they're going to want to go somewhere else and start a family elsewhere. So that the parents that you're seeing feeding young, that's their little spot there, and that they're going to maintain that. And there's enough food to feed young, but there's not going to be enough to say, okay, we're going to subdivide this territory and give you kids the back 40, and you other kids will give you the side. And it's not like that if you've got 40-acre pasture and you're a farmer and you subdivide and give your kids. It doesn't work that way. So typically what these birds are doing is they're replacing future generations of bald eagles that are going to go somewhere else. They're going to maybe be a floater for a while, and especially for a bald eagle, because they take 5 years to get their adult plumage, and they don't nest until about that fifth year. I think there are some records of younger eagles nesting, but typically not till their fifth year, and eagles can live in the wild 30, 40 years, long time. They're pumping out young to be the future bald eagles in different parts of the area. They might move upstream, downstream. Some of those eagles might even migrate somewhere else and fill a vacancy somewhere else, not even close nearby. So does that answer your question, Pat?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I'm so thrilled to see American bald eagles kind of coming back. And
yep.
After all the DDT poisoning and that kind of stuff, I find it very encouraging to see American bald eagles.
That's right.
Out
very
in the wild.
Very cool. Very good. Cool that you're seeing them, Pat. Thanks for your call.
All right. Thanks.
And I'm right there with you, Pat. I went back home to my old stomping ground in Ohio a few years ago, and growing up, there were no Falcons, even though our local college football team was named the Falcons. There were no Falcons, there were no bald eagles, and there were no Canada geese.
Yeah.
And the last time I went back in 2014, now this was back in the 70s, they just didn't exist, and I went back there in 2014, saw a tremendously beautiful flock of Canada geese all along the river, just sitting on the ice floes, and bald eagles all over the place, and falcons, and also hawks.
Yep.
And so the predatory birds have come back into most of them are migrating down from Canada.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So that's a very interesting. I'll tell you a long story later on about filming the birth cycle of a peregrine falcon when I first started out in public broadcasting
all right.
that time. So, all right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have Diane and Thomas on hold here, and we're going to go next to Pierre from Bossier City. Pierre, what's your question tonight?
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
4 years in my backyard in there, we had nightingales.
In Bossier City, you had nightingales, or are we talking about back in France?
No, I'm not from... How did you get I'm from France anyway?
Oh, Pierre, listen to your accent. It's beautiful.
Okay. Well, no, in Bossier City.
Okay. Well, let me correct you first. We don't have nightingales in the U.S.
What was singing all night long then?
Well, the mockingbird. If it was singing at night and a beautiful song, it was a mockingbird, the northern mockingbird. So the nightingale, you've got to go to Europe to find that one. So that was going to be a mockingbird singing all through the night. And it's a beautiful song. So did he keep you up at night?
Well, he can get annoying sometimes, but it's also very pretty.
Yeah.
And my concern is, and I haven't heard a peep out of it this year.
Well, we've talked about mockingbirds that sing at night, and let's listen here. Bill's queuing one up. He's doing all kinds of imitations. So what we've talked about before with those birds that sing all night, Pierre, those are unmated males, and they're in hyperdrive trying to get a mate. And so that's the idea. That's the theory of why some and not all mockingbirds sing through the night, that they're unmated males that are looking for love. How about that?
How about that?
And they didn't have to go to Paris to find it. So,
and there's nothing other than bringing him female. There's nothing you can do to attract them.
That's correct. And so you have to let nature play its course. So there's nothing we humans can do to make a matchmaker of mockingbirds. And we don't have any shortage of him. He's going to be maybe single for a few months, maybe a year, but it doesn't take long for a female to come in and set up shop with him. So, yeah.
Are they all year round, or do they migrate?
They're year round in our area. There is some seasonal movement in mockingbirds, but for the most part, they're year round residents. So, your bird is probably the same bird all year long and year to year. So, yep. So if he's not singing at night anymore, guess what? He found a girlfriend.
He's not lonely anymore.
Yes, he's not lonely. That's right.
You can play him a little love song music, a little, Harry Belafonte or something.
Yes.
A little Mantovani there.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Pierre.
Thank you, Pierre. And, of course, I had that mockingbird outside my bedroom window for a couple of years, so he must have not been a particularly sporting fella, looks-wise.
So. Yeah.
Anyways, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Thomas from Longview is calling back in a second with a follow-up question, but first we've got Diane online. Diane from Shreveport, what's your question tonight?
Hey, well, it's actually Diana.
Oh, Diana, oh. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No worries. I have a question for you, though, about a little house sparrow.
Okay.
First, I found this little guy at Lowe's outside. He was 6 days old, and I raised him.
Wow.
And so he imprinted on me, and I realized couldn't let him go. But they're invasive species, so it's all right having him. But anyway,
yep.
We hang out a lot, and sometimes I wonder about getting a little friend for him.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered, since house sparrows can be kind of aggressive and territorial, what kind of friend do you think I could get for him?
Well, you can always get another species of cage bird and just don't put him in the same cage. So in other words, a budgie, a bud garriger, a parakeet, you could have one that's in an adjacent cage, because you might not want to mix those two together, but just as long as they can see each other might be good. But you're correct that the house sparrow is not native. It doesn't have any federal or state protection. It's one of the few birds that you could do like you've done and kept it in captivity. And so we don't encourage that, of course, with any native species. Unless you're a rehabilitator, and most rehabilitators know to try to get the bird out back in the nature if they can. If it's impossible, maybe into a zoo or another facility that's educational. But your house sparrow, I would say, maybe look for another young sparrow next breeding season and see if you can bring one home. But if that's not an option, I'd say go to the pet store and look for a budgie. And you can pick one up for, I don't know, $30-$50, something like that, and just keep the cage nearby, and maybe they'll enjoy watching each other.
Okay, well, Okay. Now, I thought about before, obviously, I don't go trolling for little baby birds. I thought this guy was going to die, and I didn't want him to live his last moments out and Lowe's on the floor.
Right.
But if I did find a baby, and I did raise it, if it's female and they start breeding, I mean, what would I have to do then?
Well, so it has, you know, it got into adult plumage pretty quick. So you're saying it is a female?
It's just... the bird that I have is male.
Okay, so he's gotten the black hood. So he's pretty attractive.
Yeah, his name is Piro. He is very handsome.
Okay, cool. and so you're asking if you did find a female and they bred, well, then you're going to, you know, you're going to keep all these guys and they're just going to keep breeding and you're going to kind of simulate what happened with these birds in nature, that they were brought in unnaturally and they just bred like rabbits. So I don't know that I'd go that route. Plus that might be difficult to do. But I don't know anybody that's done that, but I'd get that house sparrow a parakeet buddy and see how you can do keeping them interested in another bird that's squawking and talking right next to them and moving about, and they'll eat similar stuff. It shouldn't put you out too much, but I don't think I'd be worried about breeding sparrows. I wouldn't want you to get in that kind of business. You'd have to maybe quit your day job just to stay home and tend to all these baby birds. So,
and my apartment is not that big.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. So you got your hands full.
Do you think they could ever, the budgie and the sparrow, do you think they could ever be roommates if they liked each other?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would say if you have them together for months, and just see how they do and get the cages even closer together, you could maybe try to integrate them after, I'd say, 6 months. Just kind of see how they do and make sure the cage is big enough that, you know, if there is a fight, they can separate. And also you've got gloves on ready to separate the fight. The house sparrow's not going to hurt you, but the budgie, I mean, they don't bite too hard, but they can grab a piece of your finger that it would hurt. I would do it slowly. I would integrate them slowly and see if they want to be together in the same cage. And, you know, that might not need to be the end goal. As long as they're in the same room, that might be good enough. So unless, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what happens. So I would say, Diana, if you're going to go that route, we'd love to hear back from you in 6 or 12 months.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll keep you updated.
Yeah, yeah, and the saga of the lonely house sparrow, and you can let us know what, you know, it doesn't have to be parakeet. It might be a cockatiel. Mm-hmm. So just something that's legal that you can have that's very common. A zebra finch. That might even be a better idea than a cockatiel or a parakeet. So zebra finches are cheap. They're plentiful, and they're half the size, maybe even smaller than that, of a house sparrow. So try a house. Try a zebra finch and see if they like each other, and go that route.
Okay, and one last question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I have heard that birds will change their behavior towards their human flock when they're introduced to other birdies. Do you think that's real likely to happen?
Yeah. You mentioned it earlier that the bird's imprinted on you. Is that what you're talking about? And that if you were to release it to the wild or maybe with other birds, it is going to act different. I mean, it's never really interacted with another bird. So it has imprint on you. So that's going to be a big part of this learning as well. You're going to find out how this bird reacts to another bird. That's why, again, I wouldn't recommend putting any species in there in the same cage at the same time until 6 months or so has passed and it looks like they're going to be buddies.
Yeah, I just wondered if he likes to cuddle on me and we watch.
Oh, wow.
We watch Planet Earth together.
Oh, wow. Okay, so he comes out of the cage and sits with you.
Oh, yeah, every day. I just was hoping if I introduced him to another birdie.
Yeah.
If he would not want to hang out with
his
mom.
Well, I'll tell you, if I was that house sparrow, I'd be super jealous. So don't tell the house sparrow that I told you to bring home another guest.
Okay.
He's gonna be mad at me. But what are you feeding him?
I feed him a mixture of parakeet seeds, pellets. He gets fresh vegetables and fruit, so like spinach mm-hmm. and green apples. Cool. And I also raise mealworms for him.
And he loves those, like spaghetti?
He loves the mealworms.
That's so cool. That's excellent. Well, I'm really glad you called, Dana, because this is definitely unusual. Rehabbers, you know, licensed rehabbers, they don't usually mess with this because they don't have a lot of time. You know, most of them specialize in raptors. Not all of them. I shouldn't generalize, but what you're doing is, I think, pretty unique and sounds pretty cool. But, you know, you're probably your sparrow's best friend. So, you know, you might not get it a buddy because he has imprint on you. And you just need to be the one that comes home and turns on the Animal Planet and watches a show with him every evening. So it sounds like a pretty cool friendship.
Yeah, we're very close.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, house sparrows can be very long-lived in the wild. And most birds are typically much more long-lived in captivity because they don't have to deal with predators and flying into windows and disease and all that stuff. So your bird, I think that I've read that they're 15 to 20 years is a house sparrow. So, you know, it's off the top of my head there. But your bird could live a long time. So you might have this buddy for a while if you keep, especially the way you're feeding them. It sounds like you're giving them really healthy stuff and a wide variety of stuff. So that's pretty good living.
I keep him in the lap of luxury the best I can.
Yeah, and that's cool that you watch the show together. Hey, take a selfie.
Yeah, take a picture.
Take
and
a
send
selfie
it to us.
And send it to us. We'd love to see that, Diana, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I sure will.
Okay.
He's in bed right now, but you know, he goes to sleep when the sun goes down.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Guys, one that I
okay.
Yeah, the email to send that to is on the post on our website, but it's wbeckett@lsus.edu, and you can find a link on the post for the tonight's show where we'll post the audio for later on. So,
yeah, that'd be cool, Diana. Thank you so much for the call, and keep up the good work with your house sparrow.
All right, thanks,
yeah.
Guys.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, and Thomas from Longview is calling back with a follow-up question. Thomas, you're back on. What's your question?
Incidentally, boy, I really envy Diana's bird.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Good living.
I didn't know, you know, that really you could, you know, sort of do that with a house sparrow. But and where do they come from? Where are they from, house sparrows?
House sparrows are Eurasian, and they were brought into the U.S. Over 100 years ago and released in various places, but most notably in New York City. And they have expanded from coast to coast. It didn't take them very long to reach the Pacific coast and all points in between. So they're an introduced bird that is very tied to humans. The name house sparrow is apt because, you know, it's appropriate because they're in close association with humans. They'll build their nests on the edges of houses.
On the eaves and so forth. You know, I used to have to. My grandmother, way back, it seems like 100 years ago, you know, would get her, you know, her grandkids, me included, to, you know, clean the nest out every, you know, whatever. All right. And also, my question was, you know, the endangered ivory-billed, I guess, woodpecker or something, and, you know, we read about for years and so forth. Well, being from, say, around Houston, and also here in East Texas, I have seen, and ever since I was a kid, these, you know, gigantic red-headed woodpeckers, bigger or as big as small chickens, and we always call them Indian hens.
Yep.
But that's not the ivory billed, is it?
Absolutely not. You know, the last record in Texas that was documented is 1904. So the Indian hen and the bird that you and everybody else and myself are seeing that is a large woodpecker in the listening area and occurs in a big chunk of the U.S. is the pileated woodpecker. So look that up. Pileated woodpecker. A pileum is a crest or a top notch. It's a flaming red crest. He's black and white. He's roughly the size of a crow.
Right.
He's not as husky and chunky as a crow, and very vocal. Here, Bill is queuing up the song, the call. Listen.
That's the guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. That's the guy. I've seen, you know, so many of them, and when I go to Little Bend, down there from time to time, I'll see them down there now.
And they're pretty tolerant. I've seen them in the city limits of Houston. I've seen them in my backyard in Nacogdoches. They're on campus there in Nacogdoches. They just do well wherever you have big trees in the city. They'll acclimate. They're not wary. But they are a large woodpecker, and they were confused with the ivory-billed. But once you get a picture of both of them, you'll tell that they're quite different. They're very different looking.
So the ivory-billed, I understand. You know, if I remember what I was reading, you know, sometime way back, is that, you know, their habitat, I think, is disappearing. They like 40 or 60 year old pine trees or something. And where are they now?
Yeah, there aren't any ivory bills left, unfortunately.
They're down.
There have been sightings that started in 2004. It didn't get to be public till 2005. In the White River and Cache River areas of Arkansas, none of those have really produced a slam dunk cover photograph. But in my area in East Texas, we just haven't had any. In any sighting anyone has, if they think it's an ivory billed, they better produce a photograph with it. Otherwise, we're going to just go with a misidentification of pileated.
And are they as big or bigger?
They're bigger. Ivory billed is bigger, larger, heavier, bigger billed than a pileated. They occurred in forests that had a lot of dead and dying trees. And mature trees, big diameter trees, and with
old growth,
exactly. And with the logging, with the felling of all the old trees, that was really what did it for the ivory build.
Yeah,
and they needed big chunks of real estate to do it. They couldn't handle, you know, 20 acres here, 14 acres over there.
Right.
They needed thousands of acres of contiguous big bottoms or big forests. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but thank you again for the call, Thomas.
Yeah,
and
thank you for the info.
Yep, very good. Thanks, Thomas.
And I have a curious question. Do we have any audio quality recordings of Ivory Bill?
Yes, and those were actually recorded in this state, in Louisiana, near not far from Monroe, Louisiana, is the Tensaw National Wildlife Refuge. Well, before it was the Tensaw, it was the Singer Tract, as in the Singer Sewing Machine Company. They owned a big chunk of land near Tallulah, Louisiana. And so some researchers from LSU in the 30s went down there and got our first and only decent recordings plus video of an ivory-billed woodpecker. And a lot of that's floating around on the internet, especially on the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's webpage. You can Google Cornell Lab of Ornithology and ivory-billed woodpecker and find those recordings. And maybe we'll bring that next month. How about we not feature the ivory bill, but we'll bring a recording and let people like Thomas hear that on the air.
Just thought it'd be interesting to compare that to the pileated, since they tend to get mixed up. And are they similar calls?
No. So looking at them side by side, they're similar, maybe like Ethan Hawke next to Tom Cruise. But, but boy, you start seeing the differences, and they're night and day difference. And then the calls, it's as different as Dolly Parton to Johnny Cash. I mean, so vastly different. And so let's do that next month. We'll play both of them. So, and if you're interested in hearing about this, tune in next month. The next episode is going to be January 9th, and we'll try to remember to play the ivory bill woodpecker along with the pileated, and you'll be able to tell for yourself, he's right, Dolly Parton versus Johnny Cash, they're vastly different.
There you go.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We have time for one more quick question if you want to call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 855-282-8502. At this time, we do have an online question, and that's about mourning doves. That person wanted to know, are they migratory and are they migrating now? And if they are, when they come back, will they come back to the same habitat as before?
Yes, and the answer is yes, mourning doves are migratory. They never, ever leave our listening area. Completely leave our area. So we'll get a lot more northern birds coming down here. Probably some of our birds that bred here leave. But in other words, we don't have a mourning dove free period. That's the good thing. But they are highly migratory. You know, that's a popular bird at backyard feeders. We mentioned black oil sunflower. Mourning doves really like that. And they don't often like to get up on the feeders. They're kind of big and clumsy. So they really like it when the other birds knock seeds down the ground. You'll see mourning doves feasting off the ground.
We have one more quick call before we go to our conservation tip, and this is Sarah from Longview. Sarah, we need your quick question, but please make it quick because we're running out of time.
Okay, so my aunt, we live on the edge of Longview, like toward Gilmer.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt this morning, we live right next door to my aunt, she saw a bald eagle.
Okay.
We don't live close to like a... really close anyway to a big body of water or
right.
anything. I was wondering, is it possible that we might see that eagle again or more eagles, or is it probably just passing through?
They go lake to lake, and I've seen them over Nacogdoches and probably going from Rayburn to Lake Nack, and that's not very far. That's like you driving from your one big box store to another different big box store across town. So it's not that difficult for a big bird like that to go body to body of water. So I think what you saw is a bird that was just in between water bodies. And so you could see them again. You'll sometimes see bald eagles eating roadkill.
Okay.
But usually they're going to the bodies of water that are nearest you.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks
Great.
So much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Bye-bye.
And as always, we close out with a conservation tip. And what do you have for us this month, Cliff?
This month, we're going to talk about bridges and culverts. Without bridges and culverts, we wouldn't be able to drive our vehicles back and forth along our roadways. But did you ever think that the water flowing under that bridge or through that culvert is also a travel way for fish that need back and forth flow? The concern here isn't with roadway runoff like the culverts under your rural driveway, but with culverts on natural flowing streams and creeks. The species we profiled earlier in this episode, the belted kingfisher, relies on waters that allow fish and other aquatic macrofauna to move freely up and down our streams and creeks. During dry periods of our streams and creeks, many fish and wildlife, some even at the microscopic level, often wash downstream or disappear. After the rains return and the water flows again, these critters that wash downstream will travel upstream to recolonize their former haunts. A bridge or culvert installed incorrectly that creates a drop-off or a slight waterfall won't allow these animals to swim back upstream to their former homes. So when you or your local government officials are replacing that old bridge or that culvert, ensure that the stream can flow in both directions. When in doubt about installation, bury that culvert about 5% of its diameter to eliminate creating a drop-off. Also, divert your road drainage off before the crossing with wing or lead-off ditches so you don't overload your culvert with more water than it can handle. This will also keep sediment from clogging our waters. It's a win-win for your road and the critters you enjoy seeing from the road. Do it for the birds.
All right, and I want to thank you, Cliff, for joining us again tonight. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we want to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program. And I personally want to thank Cliff for joining us tonight again. Thanks again, Cliff.
Had a good time. Thank you, Bill.
This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for the show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Sheila Lawrence tonight. The audio for this program tonight will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to the program again then here at redriverradio.org. The next program of Bird Calls is going to take place on Tuesday, January 9th. We hope you'll tune in for then. And an exciting program coming up hopefully in April is a Birds and Bees program featuring both Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. We're going to mix them up together a little bit and see what we come up with. Give us a call about that. You are listening to Red River Radio, and this is your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin-Nacogdoches.